to All Things EAP, a podcast produced by practitioners across the globe and hosted by Barleap. It provides a fun and friendly look at every aspect of EAP, helping you keep up with the latest developments and building an inclusive and equitable community around the world. Following the Barleap values, we hope to be collaborative, professional, developmental, and inclusive. Each episode, we'll dive into an aspect of EAP with discussions, reflections, and insights from practitioners in different contexts. Whoever and wherever you are, we hope you find this podcast informative and insightful. Welcome to the latest episode of All Things EAP. I'm Laura Richards at the University of Leeds.
And I'm Paul Breen from UCL and also part of Barleap's Social Justice SIG.
Today's episode is brought to you by the Teacher Education in EAP SIG and the Barleap Access to Literature Project. These two projects both delve into the ways in which EAP practitioners can and want to access literature and CPD, and it's a really interesting look into the picture around the globe for EAP practitioners in terms of their own professional development. Paul, you've had a listen to the discussion. What were the highlights for you of the discussion?
Well, I felt that there was a really international feel to this episode and some great practical examples of research. I was particularly interested in anything to do with technology-led learning mm-hmm. and the practical development of people in their workplaces. But I think from a social justice perspective, I was also very interested in the barriers to accessing some of the resources that people need in order to develop fully as EAP practitioners, particularly around such things as library subscriptions, for example, or conference attendance or courses in professional development. So there's a lot in here in terms not just of research, but also practical ways in which we can develop and some of the barriers to that development.
Yeah, definitely. And I think the two projects, so the first of which being a piece of research from the Teacher Education in EAP SIG, looked at trying to understand what CPD EAP practitioners want to be able to access. And then the Access to Literature Project, which was a Barleap-funded project, highlights that the picture looks quite different around the world. And I think one of the things you've just mentioned there is access to libraries. And this is something I never think about as a practitioner, because I feel very privileged that I work at an institution that has a huge library and is very willing to buy in new material as and when we request it. But this was something that I just never would have thought of before.
Yeah. And again, I suppose I'm in the same position, but I am aware that not everyone is in that position of privilege. And I think they're almost caught in a catch-22 situation in some ways, in that in order to get into that position, you do need access to these resources. You need to go to conferences. You need to read the materials related to our field. But it can be quite costly, not just in terms of money, but also time.
Definitely.
So there's a lot of issues there. And I think listeners will find this very informative. And just to get that international perspective as well, just shows that a lot of these issues are universal, actually, across our practice.
Yeah, there was a mention of colleagues on precarious contracts who don't get funding for conferences or time off as well. So it isn't just an issue internationally. It's definitely something that hits close to home as well. But I was very heartened to hear that practitioners who find themselves in the position of not being able to access these higher profile resources do listen to podcasts. So it's nice to know that we're doing something that can reach those practitioners who really want to develop their understanding of these topics within our discipline and don't necessarily have access to those resources. So without further ado, on to the discussion. So you're going to listen to Michelle Evans, Carol McDermott, Lindsay Knox, and Yan Hua Loyu talking about their two respective projects. Enjoy listening.
Welcome to the episode. I'm Michelle Evans. I work at the University of Leeds and I'm part of the podcast production team.
Hi, I'm Lindsay Knox and I work at the University of Edinburgh.
I'm Yinhua Niu from the Hong Kong University of Science and Technology in Guangzhou.
And I'm Cara McDermott. I work at the University of Glasgow. And with Lindsay, I'm co-chair of the Teacher Education and EAP's Bali Special Interest Group.
Wonderful. So the episode's about continuing professional development for EAP practitioners. Why don't we start with introducing the two studies that we're going to talk about today? Do you want to start with your study background information, how it started?
Yeah, sure. Once we got our SIG up and running, what we realized was that we kind of had two constituent groups in our special interest group. And so it started partly to provide a space for people like me and Carol who are in roles which are concerned and interested in professional development for EAP practitioners. But we also quickly realized it would be a valuable space for people working in different contexts in EAP all around the world and who perhaps didn't have access to CPD opportunities. So that was kind of the two constituent groups of the SIG. And so one of the very first things that we wanted to do in our group is to actually get a better understanding of what CPD activity was going on in the EAP sector, what people were doing, but also what they needed. And we thought that that would help us actually plan the kind of activities that would be most relevant and be useful for colleagues in the sector.
Maybe I'd jump in and say a little bit about the Bali Access to Literature projects. It started, I think, when we were working online and you could see people's kind of situation behind them with the kind of personal libraries, you know, so many EAP lecturers having these lovely display of books behind or getting involved in reading groups. And I thought, I wonder how many practitioners actually might not have access to that lovely personal library or might struggle to access different sorts of resources for their own professional development or for whatever they need the literature for. And so that was the question, really. It kind of evolved from there. What the project was, what do we think EAP practitioners want to access? What literature do they want to access? And do they have any challenges or barriers accessing it? And what could be done about that? Shall we talk about kind of setting it up and getting it going and who was involved?
Yeah, so for the SIG, we wanted to look at what people were doing. So the availability types, institutional, individual, CPD, drivers, constraints, focus, and what people needed. We were already a team within the SIG. Well, Lindsay and I knew each other, but most of the committee, we didn't know each other, but we were an established team to start off the initial ideas for the survey, but we also workshopped it, an external event, and then revised it. And a lot of the work was done within our SIG committee team online, because we all work in different places.
It was a bit different for us, Yanha, wasn't it?
So I joined the Bali Access to Literature project when I saw an ad recruiting a co-researcher for the project on the Bali mail list. And so I reached out, had an interview, and that's how I got to know the team. And from then on, we worked as a team with Michelle and two other members, including the Bali research officers, Natisha, as well as Susie. We also had another member, Judith, joined us in the middle.
Yeah, so Bali agreed to fund it, and it would be nice to highlight to people that it is possible to apply to Bali for funding for these sorts of projects. And indeed, Bali fund this podcast. So, you know, if you have a project idea or if you want to work with some co-researchers, then that's a possibility. Just put a proposal through to Bali. I think the new research publication officer might be able to help out, Angelos, but certainly the executive committee are really supportive of project ideas. We spent a bit of time trying to figure out the dynamics as a team because we're in different contexts, different approaches and different ideas of scholarship, of teacher learning and research. Whereas I think in your situation, Carol, what you've explained is you're all part of this community.
I think our main constraint was time, really, because we're all at different times, very busy at work with the pandemic. That's when we started this quite a long time ago, picked up and put it down a number of times, but we didn't know each other. We had to work out time zones. And eventually, although all the committee were involved at different stages, in the end, it was a small core of us who really concentrated on clarifying the survey design and taking it forward.
I think that collaboration was really a plus of the whole thing. I think probably for both projects, wasn't it? Because I think sometimes when you're embarking on these kind of projects, if you're doing it individually, it can feel quite lonely, and it's good to have that team and coming from different contexts as well. I think that was a hallmark of both projects.
I would agree with that, definitely. Yeah, it was key for us. It just made it better in so many different ways. Shall we go on to talk about the methodology and some of the take-home things?
So with ours, we mentioned that we started obviously thinking about our research questions. So we were looking at what's available institutionally, what is available and supported by institutions, what do individuals do, is self-directed. And so that could be for people within their institution or working independently. What were the drivers, motivations, and then the constraints to engagement? Their focus of what they do, I'm quite interested in what people actually do in their CPD, and also what their perceived needs and wants were. So we put together the initial draft of the questions. We workshopped this to get external views on that and then refined it. We spent quite a long time trying to sort out the questions and then work out what was going to be easy and accessible for people to answer. So we had mainly closed questions. We had drop downs and lists, various things. We had open questions at various points for some extra input. But really, we wanted people to be able to answer it quickly because we know participation drops off when surveys get too long and so on. We didn't use the pre-existing one. There wasn't one we particularly knew about. We've known the Fitzpatrick et al. Article came out after ours. But when we started, we couldn't find anything specific. So that's how we started with it. And then we had five different sections looking at availability and engagement and then drivers, constraints and then focus. But we also had sections on practitioners' roles, their experience, their roots into EAP, and then where they were and how they accessed the survey.
It was a real learning curve, though, wasn't it, Carol, for us, the whole questionnaire? Because although we know sort of instinctively it's difficult to write a good questionnaire, we really found that out, actually, and all the little bumps in the road of, is this question going to work, and sort of trying it out.
This rings bells, Yanhua. Can you remember the other things that came up for us in the questionnaire design?
We spent quite a bit of time figuring out the questions we should ask and how to structure them. And for the format or platform, we use Microsoft Forms. But in the beginning, we started with something else, but Microsoft Forms is easier for us to organize. And I think, we also tried to include both quantitative or objective questions as well as open questions.
We piloted it as well. I remember one of the discussions we had was accessing participants, thinking about what sorts of networks and how do we attract people? What labels or names do we use? Like, do we say EAP? Do we say, do you teach academic language and literacies? Do you teach academic communication? You know, all the different phrases that people might be using in different contexts. And we have a big list of networks that we use. Desperately wanted to get to 100. We got 87 responses on the questionnaire. We did have interviews and focus groups as well. 12 people, I think, took part in those. I know for your questionnaire, I think you had about 130-odd from 24 different countries.
137 from 25 different countries. Okay. 76 were in the UK, which is actually by around about 50-55%. So actually, we did get quite a lot internationally, although it scatters of people around the world.
Network question is quite interesting, though, isn't it? Because I think it links with the collaboration that we were talking about. Because when you actually do these things collaboratively, you then find out about networks, you know, that you didn't know existed, that you don't have familiarity with. So I think that sort of sharing this, even through this podcast, that's actually quite useful because certainly, in your own context, you know who to contact, but actually there's a lot going on that we don't know about. And we have to be, I think we really do have to be quite careful not to certainly for us in the UK, all sort of looking inward to the UK and making sure that we're finding out what it looks like in other places and how we communicate practice and share practice.
And actually, I know from colleagues that I work contacted, for example, in Turkey and in to a certain extent in China, they were saying, we have big chat groups on WhatsApp or other chat communications. We'll share it that way, which we didn't know about, but learn. But yeah, that's a real learning point and ways to communicate. I think that could be something we could take away from talking about both these projects as a resource or a forum where we could say these are networks you can use to communicate.
Yeah, similar ideas here. I think the collaboration mentioned by Lindsay is very important among us team members. So I am based in China, so I have access to my local networks, including the EAP Association. And certainly echo the point mentioned by Carol that in the Chinese community of language teachers and EAP teachers, we use a lot of WeChat groups as well as the QQ groups. So I advertised our project through these groups, I think, hopefully, and I think eventually that led us to quite a significant number of participants for our questionnaires. We also used individual networks. I think I reached out to some faculty members in the university. I know in China, they have big language centers. So I reached out to them and also advertised on my own personal networks in order to attract people to participate in our study. And Michelle did the same thing, I think.
Yeah. I think over half of the participants came from outside of the UK. I think up to 28% from China. In terms of participants, you mentioned, Carol, in your study that participants tended to be quite experienced practitioners with a kind of good level of qualifications. I think we have a similar cohort, certainly more experienced. So over 70% had a postgrad qualification, 37% had a doctorate, 52% had a teaching qualification, which was interesting. Thinking about where teaching qualifications are required to be an EAP practitioner in different contexts. And most people have been teaching between 15 to 19 years, 60% having 30 or above years of teaching experience, but EAP specifically, most people between 5 and 14 years, with 9% over 25 years. So I suppose we perhaps didn't capture people with less EAP experience and perhaps didn't capture people on more precarious contracts. Most of our participants were in full-time employment, so part-time, but I think we didn't fully capture what we wanted to.
Yeah, I think Zara's was the same. So that's something for, future work is how do we reach more people and get them engaged in these types of surveys and find out wants and needs from them.
I think that came up very informally for me in a conversation with someone who is in a sort of slightly more precarious context and had seen the invitation to our survey but didn't think it was for them. So I think that kind of community aspect and who is your community and can you have a voice in it, me that was quite an important point as well.
Before we go on to talk about some of the key findings, we thought it might be an idea to talk a little bit more about the approach to the data analysis and that kind of collaborative approach and the ups and downs of doing that. So we've mentioned using S-forms, but then we were old school in our Excel kind of spreadsheet, going through manual qualitative coding. The interviews and focus groups, two people coded one transcript and then another person kind of did a sense check over. But it was very interesting, our different approaches to it. And the quantitative side of it, I'll let Yanhua kind of talk a bit more about that. How was it for you and where are you up to with that on your project?
So I think there's definitely a lot more that we want to do. We were very careful when we presented our findings at CREAT. We were very careful to say they were very preliminary, very exploratory at the beginning. So we did quite a lot of descriptive analysis. And so with the closed questions, we were able to produce sort of percentages and numbers of how many people did certain kinds of activities, etc. But it wasn't sort of statistical or quantitative in the way that, we might like to try and investigate further. One of the highlights of collaborating on this podcast is that we've learned that Yanhua is quite expert. So we will probably be calling on.
Okay, I would say I have some training and experience in doing quantitative analysis. Previously, I did some statistical analysis in ANOVA, t-test, logistic regression. And for our project, we try to link the participant background, such as their contract and their teaching status, whether it's full-time or part-time, and link these parameters with their type of literature they want to access or the courses they teach. So we did that bit using chi-square because all the categories, all these parameters are categorical data instead of numbers or frequency data. And we basically found two significant associations between their background and the courses they teach.
I think it feels like there's so much data available. There's so many more kind of correlations and relationships we could look at. And then trying to interpret why, you know, where does that come from? Why is that the case? For example, one of the associations was people teaching pre-university level students were more likely to say they wanted to access more discipline-specific literature. And we were figuring out, okay, what could be some of the reasons for that? Yeah. You know, is it pre-university? Therefore, they're not using the text that the students are currently working with. Therefore, they're having to source the text themselves. Are they on an international foundation year or on a pathway course? So doing all this interpretation work was interesting. And I think there's probably a lot more that we could do, really. Yeah. What about some of the key findings then? What were some of the key messages around you know, people's drivers or constraints or what sort of CPD they were accessing institutionally or individually for youth?
So I think, so we looked at both institutionally, but then we also asked a question about what people were doing, you know, from their own initiatives. And so I think institutionally, what we found was sort of like the main things that people were doing institutionally were quite ad hoc sessions. So they would sign up for things and go to different things. Technology-led learning was a big interest for people in that. People were sort of relying on maybe what you might call more traditional forms of professional development, like observations and peer observations. And they would also go to university conferences and institutional things as well. What was probably more striking within the institutional context was that, striking but perhaps not surprising, I don't know, is that things which required financial support, that, you know, if people wanted funding for scholarship or if they wanted funding for study leave, those were definitely at the lower end of the results. And so fewer of the participants were getting that kind of access to pursue their own scholarship studies or to take further courses that cost money. So I don't think that's necessarily that surprising, but it's maybe good just to have that confirmed for us as well. People were very focused on quite practical development as well, stuff that was really relevant to what they were doing in the classroom. So they wanted to develop their teaching practices in that way. And I think another sort of driver as well was the idea of community. So people were very keen to learn from each other and to talk to their peers and be part of, I think one person said, you know, having that sense of belonging to an academic community as well. So there was a sense of wanting to learn from each other.
This really echoes with our key findings. So people were saying, I want to access literature first and foremost for teaching, curriculum design, creating materials, for assessment and feedback. That's my main priority. And there was definitely a sense of, I want to be part of this community. I want to keep up to date. I need to know about the latest development. There was a little bit of a sense of, I want to keep up with something that's happening over here. So there's this impression of there's people doing great work over there and I want to be a part of it. So there was something about a little bit of center periphery. I'm not sure, but there was some message like that coming through, but people wanted to keep up to date and the idea of things shifting and moving and changing and, but the teaching focus was there.
I remember some of the more junior interview participants mentioned that perhaps that they want to have access to teaching demo videos, how these teachers actually do teaching in their practice. They want to have access to these video recordings as well as kind of observers' comments. This would, they feel, would help them grow as an EAP practitioner. This is something that strikes me because, as we mentioned earlier, we don't have a lot of less experienced EAP teachers, and this participant could probably represent some of these less experienced EAP practitioners in terms of their needs to grow.
I think what we noticed as well was that there was a big difference institutionally and independently. So the participants in our survey, we got a real sense of a community, if you like, of people who were quite happy to develop themselves without necessarily needing an institutional framework, whether or not there was one. So people, you know, were taking a more scholarly approach, if you like, and there was more evidence of scholarship within the answers to the question about what do you do by yourself. And so people were presenting at conferences, they were writing papers. That was quite striking. So a lot of agency, sometimes maybe pushed by the lack of an institutional framework, but definitely keen to take ownership of their own development.
Yeah, because it was what do people focus on? Like Lindsay said, materials, teaching, practical things, but there's less of a focus within frameworks on research methods, scholarship, research, and there was very much a sense of an appetite for more of that. I think that's probably reflecting development in the field and more people getting engaged, possibly more changes to contract types and more recognition of people doing research and scholarship within EAP. That will obviously be institution specific.
I think that kind of personal responsibility for us, one of our key themes was around kind of accountability, but also empowerment. So to have the confidence that what I'm teaching and how I'm teaching it is informed, I can explain what I'm doing the way that I'm doing it. That was definitely really clear. We did have some people saying that in some contexts, in some situations, they'd been discouraged from being too scholarly, kind of being a bit over the top and making a big deal out of, you know, and kind of some people who were using references for their lesson planning and, you know, not being encouraged in the way that we might think that they would be. That was quite interesting. Maybe signaling different expectations of what EAP practitioners are expected to do in different contexts.
I think that was true for us as well. There was definitely in some answers a sense of not so much the idea that they were being told off for doing it, but the idea that they themselves felt that they were a bit imposterish if they hadn't, you know, based things on theory and if they hadn't gone in to look at, you know, research bases to justify or to explain what they were doing. So I think that's quite interesting, and it probably relates a bit, doesn't it, to discussion in our sector about where EAP sits in higher education.
And the role of the EAP lecturer or practitioner within the university. I think there's becoming more established as, this is my sense, I have to say, of lecturers on the same status as lecturers in other subjects.
Yeah. I want to add about our project in terms of the findings about EAP teachers' access. I think the majority of the participants said they have good access, but it also emphasized the main access issues for these practitioners are the library doesn't have sufficient subscription to the literature the practitioners want to access. And most of them mentioned that, you know, we also asked them, why do you think that's the case? And most of them mentioned about it's a funding, you know, the university doesn't have funding for these kind of materials, journals, things that the teachers want to access. So limited access in this area and IT infrastructure, etc. This could stop people from trying to develop their expertise in EAP.
Yeah, there was a question, have you ever felt excluded by not having access to literature? Yeah. And some people said yes.
Mm.
And there were some differences in different contexts of some who, as Yanhua just said, who didn't have access to, you know, the internet, for example, not just to have a subscription to the library, but the digital infrastructure being in place. And there were some important differences in different contexts that came up. In the African context, for example, in South Africa and Ghana were the ones who said that having that kind of infrastructure in place can be a problem. And I think in terms of key messages, although most people said, yes, I have access to a library, but the subscriptions might be a problem. I think we thought with Barleap, if this is a Barleap project, you know, so Barleap in the community, it would be really good to acknowledge that, that internationally we're not on a level playing field when it comes to access to literature and you know, for CPD and other purposes. That was a big thing for us. Our first kind of recommendation to Bali would be, can we please acknowledge this and talk about it as a community and, you know, think about what we can do. And there were a series of kind of suggestions and recommendations that's been forward.
Even things like your report, though, and ours is going to be an open, the proceedings even for the first round of our findings are useful steps forward and contributions. At least people can read about some research. Maybe it's also, it might be part of your recommendations, having a forum or a place which is, these are open access journals or these are top open access repositories. Lots of journals will have something open access for a certain number of articles. It would be important to give people access. I think that's in the whole general field of English language teaching. I've come across this before in IATEFL a long time ago. How do people get access?
Yeah, that's definitely up there. The open access was really important for people. Yeah. Grey literature, webinars, blogs were noted, reading groups, you know, as well as relying on colleagues. But definitely the Bali Six were mentioned. Some people couldn't afford, the institution didn't have a Bali membership and they couldn't afford an individual membership. So that was a bit kind of closed for them. But one of the things we thought was about support with subscriptions to Bali, but certainly the SIGs and Bali events and other events, webinars, blogs were really valued. And the whole question of how to help, for example, on pre-sessional courses in the UK and other contexts, you know, summer tutors who might come to do a pre-session summer, how to help them to get access throughout the year, I think has been a bit of a discussion in some UK universities, certainly at Leeds and other places.
That was definitely something that came up in our survey as well, that when people talked about community, they were talking about Baleap SIGs, but also outside Baleap, other associations that they were members of as well. So consolidating that so people know where these things are and how they can get to them. It's quite important.
Yeah, I agree. I also want to echo that point with kind of the point of a community, the SIGs. I think I personally also participated in the SIGs, some of the SIGs. It's very interesting, you know, people gather together to discuss issues as well as sometimes even reading the same article. And this refers back to the point Michelle mentioned about reading groups. I have a strong impression of the point mentioned by at least two of the interview participants who mentioned they went to these reading clubs or circles in their own institution. So one of them mentioned about their department has an institutional kind of mechanism to set up reading groups. And they also have a personal one. Some individual members of the faculty would set up reading groups to discuss articles regularly. Mm-hmm. And this serves as a kind of a momentum or a motivation for them to keep on reading and discussing things that are important for their practice.
It's quite interesting, just because it reminds me of one of the findings that we had, which I'll just check that I've got the right information. So when we asked about institutional activity, so things that were organized for practitioners, one of the least popular options, so only 13% of people, it might have been available, but they didn't actually join EAP reading groups or journal clubs or anything. So even though they were in a context where they did have access and quite a rich access to literature, it wasn't one of the things that they took advantage of, which I was curious about. I don't know that we arrived at an understanding of that.
Yeah, the participants are probably located in China and one in the Caribbean. That's not, you could be, I mean, whether is there a difference between these different contexts, I don't know. But just the background information.
Yeah, we haven't untangled that to know whether it's context specific. It's not part of our survey, but we certainly know from our SIG that if we have a reading group, once we find an open access journal, they're usually quite well attended.
Definitely some key themes overlap there around institutional support, personal motivations and the role of community and things like that. So what's next for your project then? What do you want to do next and where can people find out more?
I think as Carol mentioned, we do want to kind of get back to it and look at to see if there are those links and you know, if there's a correlation or if there's any relationship between who's doing what and, you know, and if it relates to their experience, if it relates to their context. So I think there's a bit of work to go back to that. But as always, it's just finding the time to do that and carving that out. I mentioned earlier, we did present our preliminary findings at the EAP conference Crete in April, and those proceedings are very soon to be available, I think, and that will be an open access.
It's open access. It's imminent. I've got the DOI today, I think.
Yeah,
so I will put that also on our web pages.
And with the Bali Access to Literature study, that report, I think we might have to create an executive summary as well, because it's quite a lengthy report, isn't it, Jan?
Yeah.
So we can put that link and make that available. That'll be on the Bali website. Thank you again for joining me.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of All Things EAP. We really hope you've enjoyed it and that you've found something interesting or useful in it. We really want to hear from you as well. So if you'd like to share a comment, suggestion, or an insight into something that we've talked about on one of the episodes, please send us an email or voice note at podcast@barleap.org. But you can also get in touch through X, formerly known as Twitter, and our YouTube channel, which are both @AllThingsEAP. Thank you again for listening, and we hope that you can join us for the next episode. Take care. Bye-bye.